So back in 2023, Nathaniel Chastain became, you know, the first person ever to be convicted of NFT insider trading.
Right, the very first.
Yeah. And I mean, he was caught completely red-handed, sentenced to federal prison, the whole nine yards. And his digital footprint was just permanently etched on the public blockchain for literally the whole world to see.
Which is, I mean, that's the crazy part of the modern digital economy.
Exactly. But there was just one massive problem with all of this. By 2026, the courts looked at it and decided that, well, no actual federal crime had even been committed.
Right. It all just completely fell apart.
It did. And welcome to our deep dive, by the way. Today, we are opening up this massive stack of legal rulings, market analysis, basically everything covering this incredibly bizarre saga.
It really is bizarre.
Yeah. And our mission today is to explore this profound paradox at the heart of the digital economy, because you have the blockchain, right? A completely permanent, totally transparent public ledger. It completely exposes a person's secret actions, but then that collides head on with a traditional legal system that relies on these really rigid, centuries old definitions of what actually constitutes fraud.
Yeah, and that collision, I mean, that is the defining tension of this entire story.
Totally.
Because this isn't just, you know, merely a true crime narrative about an employee going rogue. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is that. But it forces us to look really closely at the razor-thin line between behavior that just violates corporate policy or basic ethics and behavior that actually crosses the statutory threshold into federal fraud.
Right. Right. Because being a bad employee isn't inherently a federal crime.
Exactly.
And when you look at the timeline of the Chastain case, I mean, it serves as the absolute perfect stress test for that line. We're talking about a former OpenSea product manager who was formally convicted by a jury.
Sentenced to.
Yeah. Sentenced to prison, only to have the entire legal framework of his prosecution just crumble to dust a few years later.
Which is wild.
So, to understand how that actually happens, we need to look at the raw mechanics of the scheme first, like before the lawyers ever got involved.
Right. How did he actually rig the system?
Exactly. So according to the source material, Nathaniel Chastain was OpenSea's very first head of product. And in that specific role, he held this remarkably powerful lever.
Oh, yeah.
He was the guy who ultimately decided which NFTs would be featured on the OpenSea homepage.
And, you know, context is really crucial here for you listening. Think back to the height of the NFT market. That homepage placement on OpenSea,
yeah.
I mean, that was the ultimate kingmaker position.
Oh, totally. A license to print money.
Right. The market analysis notes that the second an NFT collection was featured on that main page, it generated this massive immediate surge in visibility.
And visibility meant price spikes.
Exactly. In those highly speculative markets, visibility translated directly into significant, you know, tangible price spikes.
Yeah.
So he controlled the spotlight in an ecosystem where the spotlight was worth a ton of money.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second. It's like a supermarket manager, right?
Okay.
A supermarket manager who knows exactly which brand of cereal is about to go on this massive, highly advertised end cap display.
Right, right.
But instead of just, you know, stocking the shelves like a normal employee, they secretly buy out all the boxes themselves.
Before the display goes up.
Exactly. And then they flip them in the parking lot at a massive premium to all the customers rushing in.
That is a perfect analogy. Because the speed advantage here wasn't some, you know, complex, algorithmic, high-frequency trading execution.
Right. It was just knowledge.
Just having exclusive knowledge of a publication schedule. So Chastain would secretly buy these NFTs right before he featured them on the homepage, wait for that inevitable retail frenzy to drive up the floor price, and then just dump them on the market.
And the records show he netted roughly $57,000 using this exact playbook, right?
Yeah, about 57 grand.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was well aware that this violated the trust of his employer and the community, which is why he actually took steps to conceal his digital tracks.
Right. He used burners.
Yeah. He routed cryptocurrency from his primary accounts through these intermediary wallets to fresh pseudonymous burner addresses.
Or sneaky.
Right. He was executing the trades from those burners and then filtering the proceeds back. He was trying to leverage the sheer vastness of the digital asset space to hide his activity.
But, and this is my favorite part, he made a fatal operational security error.
He really did.
He funded those burner wallets from his main accounts, leaving a permanent on-chain footprint.
Yep.
And the irony here is just incredible. I mean, it wasn't the FBI knocking on his door. It wasn't some sophisticated Securities and Exchange Commission sting operation that caught him.
Not at all.
It was everyday market participants.
What's fascinating here is what people call the blockchain paradox.
Right.
The community basically crowd-sleuthed the entire operation.
Right.
By September 2021, regular users were just monitoring blockchain explorers.
Like Etherscan and stuff.
Exactly. And they analyzed the timestamps of when specific NFTs were being accumulated. They matched those timestamps to the OpenSea homepage feature schedule.
Oh, wow.
And then they just followed the transaction graph backward. Because, you know, the blockchain is an immutable public ledger.
You can't hide it.
You can't. Those funding flows, literally the gas money he sent to the burner wallets to facilitate the trades, linked right back to his primary identity.
So they just posted it.
Yeah, they posted the transaction hashes on social media, essentially exposing his entire operation in real time.
Man. So OpenSea confronted him immediately, obviously. He was forced to resign, and the company quickly implemented these new strict policies barring employees from trading featured collections or leveraging confidential info.
Which they should have had all along, but yeah.
Right. But if the story ended there, I mean, it's just a standard corporate firing. You know, guy gets caught, guy gets fired.
Yeah, a minor tech scandal.
But the Department of Justice decided to step in and make an example out of him. And this is where the legal gymnastics really begin.
Oh, gymnastics is the right word.
Because how does the government prosecute a financial crime when the underlying asset, an NFT, doesn't neatly fit into any existing financial laws?
Right. The DOJ faced a really significant structural hurdle there. Because traditional insider trading prosecutions in the United States, they're almost exclusively tied to securities law.
Right, like stocks and bonds.
Exactly. They rely on the framework established by the SEC for regulated financial instruments. But the legal status of NFTs, especially back then in like 2021 and 2022, it was entirely unresolved.
Still kind of is, honestly.
Yeah. Were they art? Were they utility tokens? The DOJ knew that if they charged him with securities fraud, they would first have to prove to a jury that a digital image of a pixelated character was legally a security.
And they didn't even try to have that fight.
No, they avoided it completely.
Yeah, they bypassed the principal securities fraud provisions entirely. Instead, they hit him with wire fraud and money laundering as a predicate offense.
Right. And the money laundering charge is important to clarify really quickly.
Yeah, go ahead.
It functions as a predicate offense because money laundering inherently requires the underlying funds to be the proceeds of an unlawful activity.
Like you can't launder money if the money wasn't dirty to begin with.
Exactly. If there is no underlying crime generating dirty money, there is no money to launder. So the entire case hinged entirely on the wire fraud charge.
Right. And their legal theory for the wire fraud relied on this really fascinating piece of legal history, a Supreme Court decision known as the Carpenter case.
The Carpenter case, right.
Yeah. So to put this in perspective for you listening, Carpenter involved a Wall Street Journal reporter back in the 1980s, and he was writing this highly influential financial column.
Right. And the reporter would leak the contents of his upcoming columns to stockbrokers before publication.
So they could trade on the market impact.
Exactly. And the Supreme Court ruled in that case that the Wall Street Journal's confidential pre-publication schedule actually counted as property.
Property, right.
So the government looked at the OpenSea situation and argued, okay, OpenSea's homepage selection schedule is confidential business property in the exact same way.
Yeah, they claimed Chastain misappropriated that specific property for his own personal gain.
And initially, that legal strategy was incredibly successful.
Surprisingly successful.
Yeah, he was convicted by a Manhattan jury in May 2023, and the trial judge handed down a substantial sentence for a first-of-its-kind case.
3 months in federal prison.
3 months of home confinement, 3 years of supervised release.
A $50,000 fine.
And the complete forfeiture of all the Ethereum he obtained through those trades. The DOJ was essentially taking a victory lap.
But, I mean, I have to challenge the logic of that original conviction, though.
Oh, absolutely.
Because the comparison to the Carpenter case seems fundamentally flawed when you actually look at the mechanics of the two businesses.
Oh, so?
Well, the Wall Street Journal literally sells the news. Like, that exclusive information is its core commercial product. So if a reporter leaks it early, they are stealing the very asset the company monetizes.
Right.
But OpenSea didn't sell homepage spots. They didn't charge creators a premium to be featured. the marketplace just, you know, facilitated trades and collected a standard transaction fee on the back end.
Yeah, there was no pay to play for the homepage.
Right. So if OpenSea wasn't actually monetizing that specific scheduling information, how could the government classify his knowledge as stolen property?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the distinction you just drew is the exact fault line that eventually fractured the government's entire case.
Really?
Yeah, because the federal fraud statutes require the deprivation of money or property. If the confidential information doesn't have an independent commercial value to the company holding it, can it legally be called property?
I mean, logically, no.
Right. And that dispute became the ticking time bomb throughout the trial and the subsequent appeals process.
Which brings us to the summer of 2025, when that bomb finally detonated.
It did.
The United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit stepped in and completely vacated Chastain's convictions. Both the wire fraud and the money laundering charges were just wiped out.
Because the appellate majority scrutinized the instructions that the trial judge had given to the jury.
The jury instructions.
Right. During the initial trial, the judge essentially told the jurors that confidential information could be considered property, even if it had absolutely zero commercial value to OpenSea.
Which contradicts the whole statute.
Yeah. The judge even suggested that a scheme to defraud could simply be a departure from, quote, traditional notions of honesty and fair play.
Wow. Honesty and fair play.
And the Second Circuit ruled this was a massive misapplication of the law.
Because they relied on recent Supreme Court precedents, right? Precedents that severely limit how broadly federal fraud statutes can be applied. The appellate court clarified that not all confidential information is automatically property. For information to qualify under the wire fraud statute, it must possess actual commercial value to the holder.
Right. It needs to involve exclusive use that drives revenue or some other recognized economic interest.
And this wasn't just, you know, abstract legal debate that only lawyers care about. There was tangible evidence that the jury was genuinely confused by this during the trial.
Oh, the jury note.
Yes. The sources highlight a specific note sent by the jury during their deliberations. And that note showed the jurors actively discussing their beliefs that OpenSea didn't actually care about the information's confidentiality.
Right. They knew OpenSea didn't treat it as a commercial product.
Exactly. But they chose to convict Chastain anyway, simply because they felt his conduct was highly unethical.
Here's where it gets really interesting, right?
Yeah.
That jury note is staggering.
Staggering. They essentially convicted a guy just for being a terrible employee.
Yes.
They substituted their own moral compass for the actual statutory requirements of federal fraud.
Which is precisely why the appellate court could not dismiss those flawed jury instructions as just, you know, a harmless error.
Right.
Allowing a conviction to stand based on bad ethics sets a dangerous precedent. The justice system requires statutory precision. You cannot use federal wire fraud statutes as a catch-all mechanism to punish behavior simply because society finds it distasteful.
Exactly. And because the appellate court threw out the wire fraud conviction, that foundational pillar holding up the money laundering charge vanished.
And it collapsed right alongside it.
Which brings us to February 2026. The prosecutors basically realized their legal theory was functionally dead under these stricter definitions of property.
Yeah, they had nothing.
So rather than attempting a retrial they knew they couldn't win, they entered a deferred prosecution resolution and filed a nulla prosequi.
And for those listening, a nulla prosequi is just a formal legal notice from the prosecution declaring they are unwilling to pursue the case further.
It's a white flag.
It is a total abandonment of the charges, yeah.
Yeah.
The DOJ recognized that without a clear, monetizable property interest at stake, they had no path forward.
However, the legal world is still fiercely debating this, right? The appellate decision was not unanimous.
No, it wasn't.
There was a dissenting judge who argued strongly against the majority's logic.
Yeah, the dissent provides a really compelling counterargument regarding the nature of the modern economy.
What was their angle?
Well, that judge argued that a company's inherent right to the exclusive use of its own confidential business information should be sufficient to establish property rights.
Regardless of whether they directly monetize it or not.
Exactly. Because in the digital age, a platform's reputation and its control over its internal algorithms and schedules, I mean, those are critical assets.
That makes sense, too.
Right. The dissent really illustrates how deeply divided legal scholars remain on mapping physical property concepts onto digital data.
Right. But we do need to be crystal clear about what this ruling actually means for the market today. The court was not endorsing the behavior.
Oh, absolutely not.
They didn't issue a ruling saying, you know, front-running your customer is perfectly legal now. Go crazy.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
The decision was narrowly focused on statutory interpretation. It did not legitimize self-dealing, nor did it strip companies of their ability to, you know, fire employees or pursue civil litigation for breaches of contract.
Right.
Most importantly, it did not create some sort of blanket exemption for the blockchain from federal fraud laws. I mean, if actual property is stolen on-chain, fraud statutes absolutely still apply.
Okay, so the ruling basically served as a boundary marker.
Yes.
It warned the justice system that it cannot convert broad ethical expectations into criminal property offenses without explicitly identifying the property that was stolen.
Exactly.
But this leaves a massive vacuum, right? If the FBI and the DOJ can't effectively police this market using traditional fraud statutes, who actually protects the user?
Well, the burden shifts entirely to the private sector. The market analysis we're looking at makes it very clear that digital asset platforms can no longer wait for the courts or the SEC to definitively classify every new asset.
They have to do it themselves.
Yeah. Retail users demand a baseline of fair play. If participants suspect a platform is structurally rigged to favor insiders, liquidity will dry up and they will take their capital elsewhere.
It's bad for business.
Very bad. So platforms must proactively build what the analysis terms resilient control stacks.
Control stacks. Okay, so you can't just, you know, mandate an ethical code of conduct in an employee handbook. You have to technologically lock down the information and actively surveil the network.
Right. The implementation requires strict role-based access to information.
Meaning?
Meaning if an engineer or a product manager does not explicitly require knowledge of an upcoming listing schedule to execute their daily tasks, their access must be systematically revoked.
Makes sense.
But internal access controls, that's just the baseline. The real challenge is enforcing personal dealing rules across decentralized infrastructure. As the Chastain case proved, those rules cannot just apply to standard brokerage accounts.
Right.
They must explicitly govern self-custodied wallets.
And just to clarify for you listening, when we say self-custodied wallets, we are talking about private wallets where the user holds their own cryptographic keys, completely independent of any centralized exchange.
Right, like a hardware wallet.
Yeah, and they are so much harder for a corporate compliance team to monitor using traditional KYC methods.
Which is exactly why platforms must deploy advanced event-based blockchain surveillance. They cannot rely on standard end-of-month compliance audits anymore.
That's too slow.
Way too slow. They have to monitor the blockchain in real time, looking for anomalous accumulation patterns around the smart contracts associated with their upcoming announcements.
Wow. And the surveillance has to look for tipping too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like where an insider doesn't trade themselves, but they pass the information to a relative or venture fund or some external creator. How do you even police that on a global decentralized network?
You utilize sophisticated network analysis. Investigators use blockchain forensic tools to map the entire transaction graph.
Sounds intense.
It is. They look for common funding sources among seemingly disparate wallets. They analyze overlapping interaction patterns with specific decentralized exchanges. Because, again, wallet separation does not guarantee anonymity.
Right. The Chastain case proved that.
Exactly. The permanent nature of the ledger means every single interaction leaves forensic residue.
You know, the sources also bring in an interesting international perspective to contrast with the U.S. legal struggles we've been talking about.
Oh, right, Micah.
Yeah. They look at the European Union's markets in crypto assets regulation, commonly known as MiCA, and the EU explicitly prohibits insider dealing for crypto assets.
Right.
But they carved out this really interesting exception. They generally exclude genuinely unique NFTs from those insider trading rules.
Yeah. And the logic behind that exclusion is rooted in the concept of fungibility.
Right, whether something is interchangeable.
Exactly. MiCA recognizes that truly unique digital art is not a financial instrument in the traditional sense, so it shouldn't be regulated like a share of Apple stock.
Makes sense.
However, MiCA applies a strict substance over form approach.
Okay, what does that mean?
It means regulators look past the label. So if a developer mints an NFT collection containing tens of thousands of highly similar tokens.
Like a massive profile picture project.
Right. Or if they take a single high-value NFT and fractionalize it into thousands of identical shares, they have fundamentally altered the asset's economic reality.
Yeah, they've recreated fungibility.
Yes.
By breaking it into identical, interchangeable shares, they've functionally created an equity token. And at that point, the insider trading rules snap right back into effect.
Precisely. If market participants are trading those fractionalized tokens on liquid markets as interchangeable assets, European authorities have the statutory authority to classify them under market abuse regulations.
Wow.
The mechanism of how the asset trades dictates how the law applies.
So what does this all actually mean for you, the listener, operating in these rapidly evolving digital spaces?
Good question.
It means that right now, you are heavily reliant on the platforms themselves to act as the sheriffs. The traditional legal cavalry is bogged down in these massive statutory debates about the definition of property, and they might not be able to ride to the rescue if you get front-run by an insider.
This raises an important question for compliance teams. It demands a fundamental shift in how financial crime leaders operate.
Definitely.
The ultimate takeaway from the whole Chastain saga is that the transparency of the blockchain is an incredibly powerful tool for market surveillance.
If they use it.
Provided the institutions actually utilize it, yes. Platforms have to aggressively police their own confidential information flows and mandate strict network analysis, completely independent of whether a federal prosecutor believes they can secure a wire fraud conviction.
Right.
The integrity of the market rests squarely on the platform's own internal controls.
It is such a remarkable narrative arc, honestly. We watched the system generate the historic first ever criminal conviction for NFT insider trading, only to face the sobering reality check of that 2026 dismissal.
Yeah, it was a roller coaster.
It demonstrates that while digital markets fundamentally change the nature of the asset being traded, and, you know, they provide this unprecedented mathematically permanent evidence trail.
Right.
They do absolutely nothing to change the age-old risk of human greed.
No, they don't.
When power, secrecy, and financial opportunity converge, human behavior remains remarkably predictable.
Yeah, the underlying technology continues to evolve at a blistering pace, but the fundamental vulnerabilities of human nature do not.
Exactly. Which brings me to a final scenario I really want you to consider, pushing this logic one step further into the future.
Oh boy.
Right. We've spent this entire deep dive discussing human employees who are locked out of trading to prevent unfair advantages, right?
Right.
But what happens when a digital platform replaces its human curation team with an autonomous AI algorithm to select its featured assets?
Oh, wow.
Right. Let's say the developer who originally coded that AI studies its behavior in the wild. They successfully predict its upcoming algorithmic selections based on their intimate knowledge of its underlying logic.
Okay.
And they execute trades on that knowledge before the public catches on. Who exactly is committing the fraud in that scenario?
That is a tough one.
Is it the machine, the coder, or is it just a perfectly legal, albeit deeply unfair, market advantage? Chew on that until our next deep dive.